if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is, and see what the truth is.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.
It will be podcast.
Welcome back to the No Illusions Podcast. My name is Cameron Riley. This is a show where I talk about politics, science, philosophy, and we try and work out what's really going on in the world today. We try and peel back the layers of mainstream media and government propaganda and try and work out for ourselves what's really happening. I should also start by explaining that this show is sponsored by Podomo Cigars Australia and Podomo Cigars Asia. That's my other job. PodomoCigars.com.au if you're in Australia, PodomoCigarsAsia.com if you're outside of Australia, PERDOMO. If you're into such things, check us out. If you're not, forget I ever mentioned it. My guest today is an American academic, environmental activist, and politician from the state of Wisconsin. He is currently the Secretary of State of Wisconsin. Please welcome to the show, Doug La Follette. Welcome back, Doug.
Great. It's good to be here, and hello to folks all across the world.
As an Australian, should I refer to you as Mr. Secretary?
You can do that, or you can call me Doug or Secretary La Follette every so often, whatever's good for you.
Do you ever get called LaFo, like J-Lo?
No, I don't think so.
No, people don't abbreviate that? Okay. Well, I'll call you Mr. Secretary because it makes me sound like I'm in an episode of The West Wing, and I like that. So, Mr. Secretary, for those of us that aren't politically aware, and particularly for the people who listen to this show outside of the United States, can you start for us by explaining the job function of Secretary of State in a state like Wisconsin?
Well, that's interesting because the duties of the Secretary of State in Wisconsin, namely me, have been reduced dramatically by two different Republican governors that wanted to control things themselves. So they were able to, a few years ago, when the Republicans controlled both houses, they took away a number of important duties, including the registration of corporations and things like that. And then recently, our new governor has continued that, and he has removed some other duties like registration of trademarks and the granting of notary publics and so forth. The only real main duty that I have left is the publication of the laws. When the legislature passes a bill, it becomes an act. The governor signs the act, and then I publish it, which then makes it law. All across the country, secretaries of state have certain duties, which are very typical everywhere in the country, except Wisconsin, because we've had these two governors who wanted to remove the duties from an elected Secretary of State and put them under their control.
So publishing laws, what does that involve exactly?
It's really pretty much a pro forma activity. The law says that on the day I receive the act from the governor, I have to publish it within 10 days, but I must pick the day of publication the first day after I receive it. So I receive it today, and I say I will publish it in 6 days, and I say that will be November 30th or December 5th, whatever. That means two things. It means that we put it on the open public record. That's now done on a computer, as you can imagine. A number of years ago, it was actually done in paper form, and we actually laid a copy of it on a table in the Capitol and said, here is the official law. And then it's also published in the newspaper. My office contacts the Milwaukee Journal, which is currently the state newspaper official, and we publish it in the newspaper.
And you've been in this role since 1983?
When I was first elected, I've been doing this for about 30 years now.
Wow. How has it changed? How's the role changed in that period of time?
Well, the main change, except for technology and computers and all those things that everybody knows about, the main change is what I discussed before, that for some reason Wisconsin had this quirk that the governors wanted to take more power, and this happened twice under a governor about 8, 10 years ago, and then the current governor. So Wisconsin's Secretary of State's duties have been diminished dramatically, while all across the country, Secretaries of State have the same functions of corporations and trademarks and notary publics, a number of duties which are similar everywhere.
And this is unique to Wisconsin?
Well, for some reason, we've had the unlucky fortune of having two governors who were sort of megalomaniacs and wanted to control everything. Of course, this way they get to appoint their friends to run the agencies that they created, where they moved the duties which used to be under the elected Secretary of State. When I was first elected, I had over 50-some employees working in the office that I was elected to, and now there's only about four or five.
Wow. And as part of your official duties, do you get to celebrate with the Green Bay Packers?
Not officially, although it was one interesting thing we did some years ago. I'm a member of the state land board that manages a lot of money that was collected when the state sold the land that the federal government gave us. This is another whole area of discourse. But when the state became a state, the federal government gave the land to the state. And then under this three-person land board, of which I'm the chairman at the moment, we sold most of that land as good farmland. We still control about 80,000 acres in northern Wisconsin that wasn't that good for agriculture. But the money that we got from that is in a fund that we loan that money to schools and cities and villages for projects. And a few years ago, we actually loaned several million dollars to the Green Bay Packers because they wanted to do a renovation of their stadium. And people ask, well, how can you loan money to the Packers? The law says the money has to go to schools and municipalities, cities and villages. And, of course, do you know the answer?
I do not.
The answer is the Green Bay Packers are the only professional team that is owned by the city of Green Bay.
Uh-huh.
So it's a municipally owned professional sports team.
Wow.
And therefore, we could loan the money to the city of Green Bay to modernize the stadium.
How has that not been sold off to some internet billionaire in the last 10 years for his part of his private fortune?
I think that would cause a revolution in the city of Green Bay. The city of Green Bay is very proud of the fact that they have a municipally owned national sports franchise.
Well, good for them. That's good to see in this day and age. The people actually still own something. It's good to know.
Yeah.
Now, the other question I wanted to ask you is about whether or not you are packing heat yet.
No, I'm not packing heat. Wisconsin passed a law, as you're alluding to, when they took control recently, to allow people to carry concealed weapons. Before that, you could carry a weapon openly, but you couldn't have it hidden or concealed. And now, if you get a permit, you have to apply for a permit. And I think about 40,000 people have applied for permits in the last couple of weeks so they can carry a concealed weapon. We were the last state to allow it. Almost every other state in the country has allowed it for some time. And Wisconsin finally decided to allow it as well. I don't think much is going to come of it. I'm not sure that it's going to be a big thing. A lot of people are a lot of businesses are posting signs on the door saying that that the weapons are not allowed in their store. A number of cities and towns and schools, of course, are posting that weapons are not allowed on their facilities as well. So I don't think it'll amount to much, quite honestly.
And that's legal? They're able to do that, businesses, for example?
Correct. Yeah, the law allows people to designate their facility, be it a school or be it a private restaurant, to not allow concealed weapons on their premises if they post it, which they do. And for example, the other day I was at the university and I noticed that all the doors at the university have signs saying that no firearms or weapons are allowed.
That's interesting. I wonder if you'll see an increase in the level of death by firearm in Wisconsin as a result of more people walking around with concealed weapons.
Yeah, I doubt it because the history across the country, many states have allowed this for many years, and I don't think there's been much of a impact. I haven't seen any state-by-state studies, but when this was being discussed, people said that there was no real impact in increased Some people argued that it would decrease a certain amount of crime because criminals would be afraid that a citizen might have a gun if they went into a 7-Eleven store and tried to rob it or something.
Yeah, well, without wanting to get sidetracked, I know the stats of firearm deaths in the United States compared to similar countries such as Canada, Australia, and England, where we aren't allowed, where the citizens aren't allowed to carry weapons, a majority of them. And it's much harder to get a gun permit of any sort. You know, our gun deaths are an absolute fraction of gun deaths in the United States. So you would think there has to be some sort of a connection.
Well, the connection is that the guns are so readily available, and whether they're allowed to be carried concealed or whether you just have them out and using them, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. The gun deaths come mostly from gangs and drive-by shootings and arguments between a couple of people over their girlfriends. I mean, all those things have been going on for years, and it's because guns are so easy to get. You can walk into a gun store and buy a gun, and at gun shows, even the regulations we do have, that there have to be a so-called background check to make sure that the person does not have any mental problems or has not been convicted of crimes. That can be circumvented by buying guns at a gun show where those regulations don't apply. So it's very easy to get guns, and that explains, I think, what you were talking about.
You're probably absolutely right. Well, let's move on to talk about the recall. Now, I was in the United States a couple of months ago, driving around for a few weeks and listening to a lot of radio, a lot of satellite radio, a lot of NPR, and I think you had some elections going on at the time, and because I was a stranger to your fine country, I didn't fully understand the history and the implications. So can you take us back and help us understand what this recall is all about in Wisconsin?
Okay, I'll go through a fairly quick history, and then if you want to ask more questions to get details, we can. This all started, of course, about a year ago in November when we had the wild election all across this country. The Tea Party people took control, and they elected lots of people everywhere in this country, extreme conservative Tea Party-type people, and it happened in Wisconsin. We elected a very conservative governor, and the Republican Party took control of both the Senate and the Assembly. And we elected a Republican Attorney General, Republican State Treasurer, Republican U.S. Senator. I was the only Democrat, actually, who survived that election.
Wow.
Then in January, when they took control, the elections are in November, but the change actually takes place in January. The governor started doing some things that were not expected. He introduced what he called the budget repair bill because we had a budget deficit and we needed to deal with it. But in that budget repair bill, he had a section that would decertify all the public employee unions. That means thousands of teachers, city employees, county employees, state workers, university workers, all those people who belong to unions. Those unions would be decertified, which means they'd be abolished, and the people would no longer be able to belong to a union. Well, that was surprising and also outrageous in terms of a lot of people's belief. So when he started trying to push that through, along with a number of other things in there, like a major increase in the cost of health insurance, major increase in the cost of pensions to pay a lot more money, so et cetera. So people began to protest that, and we had a little quirk in the state Senate. There are 33 members, and this, I don't want to get too much mathematics here, but the ratio was 19 to 14, 19 Republicans. So they had a majority, but there's a quirk in the rules that say if it's a fiscal bill, if the bill involves financial issues, it takes 20 votes, and they only had 19. And so they were trying to push this thing through, and what the Democrats did, all 14 Democrats left the state in the wee hours of the night, they went to Illinois and they hid out in a hotel somewhere. Nobody knew where they were. And the governor and the Republicans went ballistic. And this went on for several weeks. And they tried to get the state police to go down and drag them back. And it was quite bizarre. And during that time, people began to protest. And there were signs and thousands of people around the Capitol every Saturday. There was 10,000, 20,000, and it got bigger and bigger. So finally, after a couple of weeks of that, the Republicans came up with a plan. They took out the fiscal part of that of the bill and just left in the anti-union part of it, and they called for a quick meeting of the leadership committee, which is the committee that decides to bring legislation forth. And that committee normally has about five members. There's Republicans controlled it, but there should be two Democrats there, one from the Assembly and one from the Senate. So they announced this meeting, and they had it just a few hours later. And there were television cameras there, so we all saw this a few weeks later when this thing went to court. It ended up in court, which I'll get to. So the Republicans said, okay, all in favor of taking this bill forward. And the one Democrat stood up. The Democratic senator wasn't there. He was still in Illinois hiding out. But the Democratic assembly member was there. And he stood up and said, no, stop. This is illegal. You violated the open meetings law. Wisconsin has a law that you've got to announce 24 hours before a meeting of the legislature if you're going to take action. And he screamed and yelled. The Republicans said, sit down, shut up. He wouldn't sit down. They said all in favor. The vote was 3-0. They passed the bill and they adjourned. And so it was an amazing situation. And by that time now, the crowds were in the thousands protesting all around the Capitol. They took the bill to the Senate. They passed it with 19 votes. And then it went to the Assembly. It passed the assembly and went to the governor. The governor signed it and sent it to me. Well, as I described earlier, and I'll refresh people's memory, when I get an act from the governor, I have to designate the day of publication within 10 days. The governor said to me, not personally, but in communication from his staff, please publish this immediately. Well, I knew what was going on. I mean, there were thousands in the streets, and there were two lawsuits threatened. A number of people were threatening to go to court because of the open meetings law, which was violated, in my opinion and in many people's opinion. And I also knew, I talked to a number of schools and cities, they were trying to get their union contracts finished quickly before this law became law, so they would have a contract they could work under. And this was true of both the labor and the management, but you know, both sides wanted to get their contracts in order. And so I was aware of all that. So I designated the publication on the 10th day. I waited as long as I could. Well, that sent the governor into hysterics, and the Republicans were calling me names. My email was crazy. I got hate mail, except you can't believe it. But by the fifth day, they were in court. The district attorney went to court, and we had a big court event. This was an amazing story of who represented me. I was represented by the Republican Attorney General, because that's how the law works when the Secretary of State is involved in legal action. And he wouldn't represent me, so I had to fight for my own lawyer, and that's another story if we can talk about later. I finally did get my own lawyer, by the way, when I stood up and said, wait a minute, Judge, I'm not being represented here. And the judge said, what are you talking about? It was kind of interesting. But anyway, the judge, after 2 days of listening, issued a restraining order, a temporary restraining order on me, saying, do not publish the law. So I didn't, even on the 10th day. And the judge said to everybody, I want to hear all your briefs, all your arguments, and in 6 weeks, then we'll hear this case. Well, things were going crazy, as you can imagine. To make a long story short, when the judge finally heard all the arguments and we saw the videotape of that meeting I described with the senators pushing this thing through with all proper notice, et cetera, the judge, she ruled that the open media law had been violated, and she issued an injunction telling me not to publish the law. And so that was good from my perspective and from most everybody who I was hearing from. Then the governor went to court and asked the Supreme Court to override her ruling. And the Supreme Court was involved in an election at that time. And there was one senator, or one Supreme Court justice up for election. He was a Republican. And there was a wild election. You don't believe it. And on election night, the Democratic woman won the election, which would have swung the court to 4-3 Democrat. Mm-hmm. But then 2 days later, suddenly in a Republican area, they discovered a bag of ballots that hadn't been counted. And when those ballots were counted, the Republican Supreme Court justice got reelected. That made the court 4 Republican to 3 Democrat. And within they heard arguments and so forth, and they made a ruling that the open media law had not been violated, which I still don't agree with, and they ordered me to publish the law. At that point, I published the law, and it became law. And the unions were all decertified, and everybody's the average state employee or teacher had to start paying $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 more for their health insurance and things like that. Okay, that was chapter one.
Well, now, can I ask some questions?
The next chapter is the recalls. We can get to that in a minute. Go ahead.
Yeah, I need to ask some questions, Mr. Secretary. First of all, why did the Democrat senators leave town? What was that trying to achieve?
Well, if they weren't there, then the Senate did not have the proper quorum of 20. And without 20 people there to make a voting quorum, they couldn't vote on it, because they only had 19 Republicans.
Oh, so they didn't need 20 votes to pass the financial law. They just needed 20 people there to vote.
In order to take action.
Ah, I understand. Okay. And my second question...
Go ahead.
No, please, go continue.
Well, because it had, the bill had fiscal implications, and then they took those out, and that would allow them to push it through without that restriction.
Right, I understand. And the second question I had was, how is it at all legal to decertify unions?
Well, these are not private unions, but they're public sector unions, teachers, government employees. And they were not even allowed to exist 100 years ago. And in fact, Wisconsin was about the first state in the country, I don't remember exactly, 30, 40 years ago, that first allowed public employees to unionize. And that was quite revolutionary, to allow public employees, teachers, to form unions. And they did. And so if the law was passed to allow them, they could change the law and say public employees may not form a union. And that's what they did.
Wow. That's astounding. Okay.
That's outrageous, in my opinion.
After we talk about the recall, we can start talking about the general political climate in the United States, because I'm sure you'd have some interesting insights. But let's move on to the recall. What happened in the next chapter?
Okay, well, just briefly before, Wisconsin wasn't alone in this mess. Ohio, Florida, several other states did the same thing. Indiana, they also decertified and eliminated public employee unions. In Ohio, if you followed it, there was a vote just a couple of weeks ago where the people overturned it in Ohio. You may have followed that. It was very exciting. The people, they had to collect something like 1 million signatures, and they collected 1 million signatures. They put it on the ballot, and about 2 weeks ago, the people of Ohio voted to reverse the law that had been passed that eliminated unions in Ohio. It was a very good result. But anyway, okay, on to the... Go ahead.
Sorry, no. Okay, well, I do have one more question. You mentioned that when Governor Walker came into office, that Wisconsin was in deep financial trouble. What's the background behind Wisconsin's financial issues? Are there easily identifiable causes for its situation economically?
No, it's nothing more than the whole country. I mean, we're in a recession. We have been for some time, and so People are not, the tax collections are not what they should be, particularly sales taxes, and unemployment's been very high. So the cost to government have been higher for unemployment insurance, and it's been a general situation. Plus, there's been across the nation lots of tax cuts for the wealthy people, particularly. So because of that, there's been less revenue coming in. So Wisconsin, most states have very little control over their economies. Most of the economy is affected by the national level. That may be true in Australia as well, in terms of it's a national economy situation that controls most of what's going on. So Wisconsin was like every other state except for one or two. North Dakota's has got lots of money because they discovered oil up there, so they're rolling in money. But other than a few examples like that, most every state has serious financial difficulties at the moment.
It wasn't Americans stopped eating cheese all of a sudden for some reason?
Nope. Nothing as wild as that.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering if there was any particular large deals that went south or industries that shut down or anything like that. All right.
Well, industries were shutting down. I mean, like all across the country.
Sure.
Many major industries, two major auto plants, one in Janesville, one in Kenosha, which are places you don't know where they are, but they closed, and thousands of workers lost their jobs there and in other factories. The general loss of manufacturing in this country has been going on for several years. Probably the last 12 or 15 years has been a trend for major manufacturers to shut down and move to Mexico or move to Taiwan or move to Vietnam or somewhere. I mean, that's something that you're well aware of.
Hmm. And Harley-Davidson is based in Milwaukee, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Isn't Harley-Davidson based in
Milwaukee? Yes, and they've been having real trouble. And what's happened is these businesses have gone to their workers and demanded a lot of concessions. They have to take wage cuts. They have to pay more for their health insurance. There's been a general trend all across the country and in Wisconsin as well for businesses to demand their workers make concessions or they will move. They'll leave.
Mm. Mm. All right. Well, thank you for that bit of background. Okay, let's move on to Chapter 2.
All right. So the next chapter is the recall. So it became law and people were not happy. There were two efforts. The Republicans wanted to recall the senators who went to Illinois because they were angry with them. And the Democrats wanted to recall the senators who voted for this law because they were not happy with them. So both groups started petitions to recall senators. And given the size of a Senate district, it takes somewhere around 15,000 to 18,000 signatures to recall a senator. The Republicans were able to collect enough signatures for, I think, three recall efforts. The Democrats were able to collect enough signatures for five recall efforts. Now, what does a recall mean? It doesn't mean that the person is taken out of office. It means that they have to stand for election again. So if a person is recalled, then there'll be an election, and they will be involved, and then other candidates can choose to be involved. It could be someone from their party or it could be someone from the other party, obviously. So what happened in these recalls is that the Democrats, the three Democrats who were being recalled, they all were reelected. The Republicans did not succeed in recalling any of the Democrats. The five Republicans who had to face recall elections, two of those were defeated. So the Democrats picked up two seats, and instead of having 14, they had 16, and then, of course, the Republicans now only have 17. So it's 17-16, but two of the Republicans were recalled successfully. So that was the recalls that you heard about as you were driving around the national parks of the West.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way the law reads, you cannot recall someone until they've been in office for 1 year. So these recalls I just discussed were people who were not elected in November but had been elected in the last election. Now it's been 1 year, so now there are new recalls just being started the last 10 days. The major one is the governor. There's an effort to recall the governor. We had a last Saturday, there was a rally somewhere around 40 to 50,000 people were rallying at the Capitol, and they were signing petitions. At that time, they estimated they had 100,000 names already. In order to recall the governor, it takes 540,000 signatures. And in order to be safe, people are aiming to get 700,000, just in case some of the names turn out not to be valid. And if that happens, then the election committee that makes these decisions will schedule an election, let's say, probably will be sometime in March, maybe April. And at that point, there would be another Republican could run against the governor. That probably will not happen. And that would force a primary. And then, of course, there'll be a Democrat or maybe two or three Democrats who will decide to run in this election. And the governor will spend unlimited money. Already, he's on television continuously. Someone estimated somewhere between $20 and $30 million has been invested already in television ads supporting the governor, because he has a lot of very wealthy friends like the Koch brothers and Americans for Prosperity, these very conservative right-wing groups that have tremendous amounts of money. At the same time, there's an effort to recall, I think, three more Republican senators, and those efforts are underway at the moment, and I haven't heard much about those. It only takes 15 or 16,000 names to recall a senator. So I would guess that those recalls will probably happen. Whether the Republicans will be defeated in elections, I'm not sure. It depends on the nature of the districts. But the big battle now is to try to recall the governor. We have until January 15th. You have 60 days. In that 60 days, they have to collect 600,000 or 700,000 signatures, and then we'll see if the election happens. There we are.
I'd like to just point out again that this podcast is the No Illusions podcast. My name is Cameron Riley. You're listening to the Podcast Network, and this show is sponsored by Perdomo Cigars, P-E-R-D-O-M-O, cigars.com.au if you're in Australia, or PerdomoCigarsAsia.com if you're outside of Australia. We deliver pretty much anywhere in the world these days. Very fine, hand-rolled, long-filler, premium cigars for people who appreciate such things. And again, if you don't, forget I ever mentioned it. In your political career, have you ever seen a governor recalled?
No, it's only happened twice in the whole history of the country. It happened once back in the 1930s or something in South Dakota, I think. Don't quote me on that. And it happened recently in California. California, it happened about 8 or 10 years ago. That's when Schwarzenegger was elected as a result of that recall.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the general political climate in the United States. As you mentioned earlier, there were huge protests happening in Wisconsin earlier in the year. I think it got to the point where there were tens of thousands of people in protests, 25, 30,000 people turning up. Around about the same time, we saw the Arab Spring, so-called Arab Spring protests happening. And now, of course, in the last couple of months, we've had the Occupy protests start in New York and then spread not only right across the United States, but worldwide. We have them here in Australia. Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne all have their own Occupy protests, all being met with equivalent levels of police brutality. What do you think's happening in the United States, Doug? I mean, over your very long and esteemed political career, have you ever seen anything like this before?
No, I haven't. I've studied it and I read about it in history because these things have happened in the past. I think the most obvious examples would be the Vietnam War protest, and I was around for those. And those were very serious. I mean, there were thousands of people in the streets who were protesting the war in Vietnam. Before that, I think the most historic one was when the unions first got organized. if you study the union history here and maybe Australia, maybe other places, where the workers were exposed to very bad conditions and they worked long hours and for low pay. And finally, the workers began to protest. The companies brought in the thugs, and the people were shot and killed. There were major protests. I mean, it was quite a period in American history. And there are some famous examples where the company thugs came in with guns, and many people were killed in those protests. And that was when the unions first were being formed. So, other than that, and the Vietnam protests, I think this is a phenomenon that is arising again now. Why is it happening? Well, I think people have just lost faith in the ability of the government to provide for their needs. If people want to read about it some, I recommend the work of Professor Reich at Berkeley. He was labor secretary under President Clinton, and he's written some very good work, including a new book, where he draws an analogy between the 1930s in this country, when the difference between the very rich and the working people had reached a tremendous gap. And as a result of that gap, we went into a depression, and then, of course, the war sort of brought us out of that depression and the New Deal and President Roosevelt and that history. But what Professor Reich points out is that we've now reached that same disparity. In the United States, the difference between the top 1% or 2% of the people who have millions and the average working person. In fact, the wages have been going down. Working people's wages have been going down, and the rich have been going up. And that's reached the point with unemployment and the mortgage crisis, people losing their homes, foreclosure, people losing their jobs. It's reached a point where people are saying enough is enough. And I think that with this tendency to try to eliminate the unions, it's been going on in the private sector for several years now. We talked about that earlier. The companies are threatening. If you don't take wage concessions, if you don't pay more for health insurance, we're going to close the factory and we're going to leave. That's been going on for several years, and they've succeeded. Most of the unions have been broken or weakened in the private sector. Now they're going after the public sector, like we talked about in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Florida, in Indiana, trying to eliminate the rights of the working people in the public sector, teachers and government employees. So it's reached a point of crisis, Cameron, and the people have to stand up, and let's hope that they'll be successful. One thing we can talk about in a minute is how this happened. This didn't happen accidentally, Cameron. It's been a long, I'd say close to 25-year organized effort by a few very, very wealthy people to take control of the United States government. And we can talk about that a little bit. There's a man named Rob Stein. If people are interested, do a Google for Rob Stein, and you can read his analysis of how this takeover took place. And I can describe that after a while if we wanted to go into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to ask you, the Professor Wright at Berkeley, is that Wright?
It's R, kind of like a German spelling, like the Third Reich, if you will. R-E-I-C-H, I believe.
Okay, excellent. I'd also add to the reading list Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, which explains a lot of that background as well, the class struggles that have gone on in the United States for the last couple of hundred years. Most excellent book. I'd like to get your perspective on how this came to be. But first, I'd ask you about President Obama's performance. You know, I remember being in the United States late 2008. I was up in Seattle spending some time with our mutual friend, David Markham, and with my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, who was living there. And it was just before the presidential elections. And I remember getting a huge sense of hope from particularly the friends of mine over there who are Democrats about the sort of change, yes, we can, the change we can believe in movement that President Obama was campaigning on. It seems to have failed. I mean, the people don't seem to have a lot of hope. There didn't seem to be the sort of change that people were looking for. As a career Democrat, what's your perspective on President Obama's performance during his first term?
Well, it's very complicated, and I thought a lot about this, and I don't have the profound answer, but here's what my thoughts are. The lack of the kind of results that people were sort of wishing for or hoping for, I think comes from a variety of reasons. The first one, and this is not necessarily in order of importance, just as I think of it, the first one is that he inherited an economic mess, mostly caused by President Bush and by people who had sort of deregulated Wall Street and let the mortgage bankers go wild. And he inherited that situation. And then he also inherited the war in Iraq, and he moved ahead with the war in Afghanistan, which he had said he would do during the election. I'm not sure whether that was a good idea or not, but those are very expensive activities. And then we had the Bush tax cuts, which Bush pushed through, which eliminated millions of dollars of revenue for the government. So he inherited a fiscal financial disaster, and that was hard to fix. Secondly, he got himself stuck with a Republican opposition. And originally, the Democrats had the control, if you know. But they didn't really act on it. I think the members of Congress can be held responsible for a lot of this, because they diddled around and fiddled around, and they didn't really get much done. And then Senator Kennedy died, and then a Republican got elected, and the Democrats lost control of the U.S. Senate. And we have this rule, which I think should be changed, that it takes 60 votes to move ahead. So if you don't have 60 votes in the Senate of the United States, nothing can happen. If the minority, if the 41 votes want to stop it. So when Kennedy had died and the new senator was elected, a Republican, the Republicans had 41 votes, and they have stopped everything. And then in the midterm election, as we call it, the election of about a year ago, the Republicans, with the Tea Party swing that we talked about that happened in Wisconsin, all across the country, the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives. And they began to do all kinds of crazy things that we could talk about. And the Republicans in the Senate continued to stop things. So Obama couldn't get much done, even if he wanted to. And then that's the second point. The third point I would make is that Obama turned out to be a politician. No big surprise. And I don't know, I'm not a human psychologist. I'm an old chemistry professor who went into politics. But I think for a black man to succeed in this country, even today, and he succeeded with Harvard and Columbia, he did very well, et cetera. You have to sort of be a compromising person. And he talked a good story during the election about change. But when push came to shove, he seemed to be more of a conciliatory compromiser. And he kept wanting to work with the Republicans. And they would have nothing of it. They said no to everything. And rather than fight, which I think he should have done, stand up and say, here's what's happening. Now, recently, he's doing more of that. The last few months, he's been more of a fighter. But for the first couple of years, I don't think he fought enough. He let the Republicans sort of take control of things too much. And therefore, he wasn't able to accomplish much. So those are my three thoughts. The economy, the fact that the Republicans were absolutely impossible. In fact, they admitted it. They've said publicly, our goal is to make sure he does not get reelected. Our goal is not to fix the problems. Our goal is not to help the American workers. Our goal is not to protect the environment. They've passed lots of anti-environmental legislation that troubles me a lot. Our goal is to make sure that Obama cannot be reelected. That is not a good way to run a country, but that's what's been going on.
Mm. What about his relationship with Wall Street? I mean, I remember even during the lead up to the last presidential campaign, I read a lot of analysis talking about how much campaign funding Obama was getting from Goldman Sachs. Do you think he has a compromised relationship with the investment bankers of Wall Street?
Sure. I mean, you can't get elected president without that relationship. Mm. I mean, that's where the big money comes from, and he's in the same boat that the rest of them are. I don't know how much that affects his daily activity, but I'll be honest, he appointed people to help run the country that came out of that, mm-hmm. that I would not have supported. I would have supported putting Paul Krugman, an economist, and like William Reich, we mentioned before. Mm-hmm. I think those are the kind of economists and people who he should have appointed. But he appointed people from Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Timothy Geithner, et cetera. Okay.
Yeah.
I know it's your Thanksgiving dinner that I'm keeping you from, and happy Thanksgiving, by the way.
Well, thank you, but don't worry about my dinner. It's only about 5 o'clock here, and I'll get home in time to have whatever I normally eat. I know a good friend of mine delivered a pumpkin pie, and I can't wait to have a piece of that.
Very nice, Mike. You have to have some sympathy for my American wife. She we struggled in vain to find somewhere in Brisbane yesterday that was going to serve turkey and pumpkin pie. There was absolutely nothing, so we ended up going out for Indian instead. So that was the best we could do. And we gave thanks to the Indians who came to Australia, and the real Indians, not the American Indians, the real Indians that came to Australia and brought their wonderful cuisine and shared it with us.
Right, well, I'm a big fan of curry. I like curry. I make a silly joke here for a little bit of humor. I say that it's too bad the Americans won the Revolutionary War, because if the British would have controlled this place, we'd have better Indian food.
That's very true.
Because, as you know, the good Indian food is in the countries like New Zealand and Australia and places where the British Empire that also controlled India at that time, lots of people went there and brought their cuisine with them.
Absolutely. And my wife's a big fan of chili. She had very hot vindaloo last night. I had to stand 2 meters away from it so I wouldn't get burned. So if you have a little bit of time, let's go back to how this all came to be. Professor Reich's analysis, with your analysis added, where did the decline start, in your opinion?
Well, Professor Reich has analyzed sort of the economic thing. The political thing was done by the man I mentioned, Rob Stein, S-T-E-I-N. And I recommend people do a Google and you'll find about him. What Rob Stein said, I heard him give a PowerPoint presentation about 6 years ago. And when I heard him give the presentation, it was like a light bulb went on, because I had lived through this. But he put it together in a package that was very analytically satisfying, although very disturbing. And here's what Rob Stein said in his PowerPoint. After the Goldwater defeat in 64, that's when Republican candidate Barry Goldwater was defeated, and he was the hero of the conservative movement. And at that point, the wealthy folks in this country were not too happy with the things were going on. There was the anti-war movement, there was the environmental movement, there was the women's rights movement, there was the gay rights movement. This is the period in the late 60s, 1970s. I was there. It was exciting, Cameron. I mean, we felt really good about stuff that was going on, including all these sort of liberal progressive activities in the 1970s. We passed lots of good environmental laws, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, et cetera, you know. Mm-hmm. The civil rights movement, with President Johnson passed the Civil Rights Act to allow minority people to vote and to participate. All that stuff was happening. So what these wealthy people did is they got together and said, we need a plan to protect ourselves. And what they wanted basically was two things. They wanted their taxes cut, and they wanted no regulation on their business activities. But they knew that going to the American public and saying, cut our taxes and don't regulate us, even that wouldn't sell. They needed a more sophisticated way to get what they wanted. So to do that, Rob Stein said there were four circles he draws on his PowerPoint. The first circle was the money. They agreed to contribute millions of dollars every year into this effort, this fund. And it was the Koch brothers and a lot of other very wealthy people. the Koch brothers had become famous because they sort of got exposed in a big article in I want to say the New Yorker, I'm not sure, but these two brothers that are billionaires have contributed millions to this cause. In fact, they set up a non-profit group called Americans for Prosperity, and they funded the Tea Party just recently. The money for the Tea Party came from these two brothers and many other very wealthy individuals. So the first circle is lots of money. The second circle was sort of the research education, and they set up lots of these so-called think tanks, like the Heritage Foundation and the Heartland Institute, and they put a lot of money into these right-wing organizations that did research, but it wasn't peer-reviewed. It wasn't real research, and they put out lots of information which could be used by politicians or could be used by the media, and they funded media. The Fox Network got started. The Fox Network didn't exist before this, and Rush Limbaugh and all the talk radio. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of stations across this country that have people on there 24 hours a day talking this right-wing stuff that they get from these think tanks. And the third sector was the media, like I talked about. So you've got the education, you've got the media, and you've got the money. But even with that, they knew they couldn't win the election. They needed what Rob Stein calls the ground troops. They needed thousands, millions of people who would vote for their Republican conservative candidates. And they thought, well, who can we get to work with us? And they found a number of groups. One was the National Rifle Association, the NRA, a very big conservative group. Another was the Christian Right. The Christian Right, the evangelical Christian movement, was coming along then. And they worked with them, and they helped fund and sponsored their activities, and they appealed to their issues. Of course, the NRA was guns. In the case of the Christian Right, it was gay rights and birth control and abortion, those issues. And then another group was the Farm Bureau. It's a large agricultural organization that is really very conservative. It's really a big insurance company. It's called the Farm Bureau. They have thousands of members across the country. So by working with these kind of groups that had large memberships, they were and appealing to their issues, talking about gay rights and gun control and agricultural subsidies, they were able to get the support of these groups. Now, just as an aside, Cameron, and I say this with a little tongue-in-cheek, these wealthy business people, they didn't care if gay people got married or whether you could carry concealed weapons. They didn't care about that stuff. They wanted their taxes cut, and they wanted the regulations eliminated. But they knew they had to get the support of these other groups to get the votes. And Rob Stein ends up his PowerPoint by saying, and they succeeded. They Shanghai'd the country. And that's exactly what's happened in this country now. They've taken control. The taxes have been cut. The regulations are being weakened. And the very wealthy people are in charge and are doing very, very well.
They managed in the late 70s to find a failed actor and wrote a script for him to play the role of the president.
Yep, and particularly with Ronald Reagan, and then with the first Bush, and then the second Bush, they have been able to, and with Congress, they've been able to basically, like Rob Stein says, they Shanghai'd the country. And trying to get it back is going to be difficult. I was in New Zealand about 9-10 months ago, just after the election. So it must have been maybe about 11 months ago. And people in New Zealand and maybe Australia would have similar questions. They said, what's this Tea Party? Explain the Tea Party to us. So I gave several talks about the Tea Party. And the first thing I always would say is the Tea Party is nothing new. It's just a new name for the same thing. And it's been funded by the same people with millions of dollars to take advantage of frustration and anger and fear of a lot of Americans. People are very nervous. They're very worried, like we said before. They're losing their homes. They're losing their jobs. Their wages are going down. Their pensions are being cut. Their health insurance costs are going up. And because of that, they can be manipulated. And these very wealthy people have funded this Tea Party and helped them be very successful politically, so they could get what they wanted out of the government, which we discussed before.
Well, the thing that amazes me looking at the Tea Party from a distance and even in my time in the US a few months ago is these people that you see in town hall meetings or on Fox News that are pro-Tea Party seem to be fighting against the very legislation or reforms in the United States that would benefit them. Like these are poor people struggling economically, and yet they're fighting against tax cuts for the rich. They're fighting against healthcare legislation. It doesn't seem to make any sense at all. They're fighting against the things that would be good for them.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's kind of what Rob Stein tries to point out, what I just kind of said. You know, these very wealthy folks have been able to manipulate and take advantage of everything from the Christian right to the Farm Bureau, et cetera. And these people are actually protesting against their own best interest, because the average Tea Party person is not a wealthy millionaire.
Yeah.
But they have been manipulated into thinking that the government is the evil, and they've succeeded with that. You know, the people like Ronald Reagan started the whole thing, saying the problem is the government. We need to get rid of government. We need to weaken government, and that they've been successful in promoting that idea. So people now don't understand that we are the government, and the government is essential to provide the services and the health care and the education and the environmental protection and the highways and the schools and the sewer treatment plants and the bridges and all the things that are deteriorating, and they somehow think we don't need to pay for those. And the answer is we do, and the millionaires should pay a lot more. And actually the polls show that now, Cameron. The polls show that the majority of people really believe that the taxes should be increased on the very wealthy to help pay for some of these things that we need in this country.
Speaking about Reagan, I read a terrific book when I was in the U.S. called Tear Down That Myth about Ronald Reagan's career in government. They were talking about his mantra about smaller government, getting rid of big government, and how most people don't realize that the debt increased by about $2 trillion while Reagan was president. So, you know, he would say one thing, and I'm sure this is not uncommon in politics at that level, but he would preach one thing and then, you know, do the complete opposite.
Well, and something else that the conservatives don't like to mention, he increased taxes many times. During his 8 years in presidency, he realized that we had a deficit problem, and he increased the taxes. But people don't seem to remember that they think he was just all in favor of cutting taxes. But he wasn't as radical as the current people are, really.
I've got a quote from the book. It says, "His promise to shrink government was uttered so often that many acolytes believe it really happened. But in fact, Reagan expanded the federal payroll, added a new cabinet post, and created a huge debt that ultimately tripped up his hand-picked successor, George H.W. Bush. What he did shrink was government regulation and oversight, which critics have linked to a series of unfortunate events, from the savings and loan crisis of the late 1980s to the subprime mortgage crisis of the late 2000s.
Exactly.
So another good book I highly recommend, Tear Down That Myth. All right, well, listen, Mr. Secretary, absolutely fabulous to have another chance to talk to you. What I would love to do is, number one, let you go home to your family and your Thanksgiving dinner and your pumpkin pie. But secondly, to invite you back onto the show maybe early in the new year so we can get an update about the recall situation of Wisconsin and perhaps talk some more about some of these fundamental issues.
Yeah, that would be great. Like I say, the deadline for the petitions is January 15th. So by that day, we'll know whether we succeeded, and then it'll take about 6 weeks for them to go through those. Imagine how long it takes to go through 700,000 or 800,000 names and make sure that they're legitimate. If we succeed, the Republicans will go to court and they will sue and they will try to disqualify the names. But if that all works out, then there'll be an election sometime in maybe March or so. So yes, by all means, let's stay in touch and continue to work on this dialogue, which I've enjoyed very much today.
All right. Well, we might schedule something for around about January 15th. Mr. Secretary, thank you again for your time. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
We will look into the mirror and see what the truth is.
You're very welcome, and I thank everyone who's been listening.
The revolution will not be televised. It will be podcast.